Welcome to the K-Connect podcast, where collective impact meets practical steps for change. The K-Connect podcast focuses on system-level work, policy, community engagement, and more.
Welcome to today's episode. So actually for today, we have two titles. We have an official title, From Policy to Practice, Supporting Student Well-Being. But we also have a not so formal title, and that's CAP. CAP is an acronym for Community Action and Policy, because that's what we're going to be talking about today. I'm excited. This is your host, Dr. Shayla Young. Well, actually, your co-host, because I got my partner in collective impact here with me, Megan Frierson.
Yeah. Hey, everybody listening out there. My name is Megan Frierson. I'm the director of system building at K-Connect. I'm excited to be meeting with two of our, deep partners from way back when, have been supporters of K-Connect and doing just great work in the community. So this is a very exciting day.
And tell us a little bit, Megan, what is the core around this episode today? It's connected to something that is happening out in community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So K-Connect, we are actually holding an education summit. So you might see some flyers out there. If you're in Kent County, see some flyers, see it on social media. We are just really excited to bring in community leaders, legislators, families, students to have these vital conversations needed now more than ever regarding education policy. I tell people all the time, when I heard about policy and when you think about it, you're like, I'm not as knowledgeable. What's my place in it? How do I advocate? And so our goal is really to bring folks together to, one, be informed, and then, two, be educated, and then be empowered to advocate for those things that are so important to you in your daily lives. And so the Education Summit is not just a one-day event on April 19th from 10 o'clock to 1:30 p.m. But we're also hosting virtual sessions, one on March 27th from 5 to 7, and another one that is on April 17th from 5 to 7. And that's kind of that preparation where we can make sure that folks are aware about what education policies even exist, what's happening now, how it impacts your local community, and then feel that empowerment, and be able to communicate with legislators the day of the event. And so in addition to those virtuals, we also have podcasts where we're able to hear from those that are in the community that are doing great work, that are able to tell their stories, because they want others to be impacted as well and to be emboldened and excited to speak about the things that matter to them the most.
Yes. And so if you're hearing Megan talk about that April 19th event or one of those virtual sessions and you're interested, why don't you go ahead and visit k-connect.org/EdSummit. And you can go ahead and register there and see all of the information about that event. I'm excited to introduce our guests for this episode. As you said, Megan, these are some deep partnerships that run deep as you think about the history of K-Connect. And so I'm going to go ahead and just really say y'all's names and let y'all do the introductions. So first up, we have Dr. Keenan King. He is the Executive Director of Kent School Services Network, or affectionately known as KSSN around our community. And just shout out to you, Dr. King, because you're one of the newest board members of the Institute for Educational Leadership. That's right. If you're listening, you're like, okay, we see you, Dr. King. Give us some snaps, right, claps, and some taps. Hit the subscribe button. All right, but Dr. King, how about you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you and what brings you into the conversation today.
So thank you, Dr. Young. I am Dr. Keenan King, Executive Director of KSSN, like she said. A little bit about me, background, about 15 to 20 years working in this community partnership, educational spaces. Did a little bit of work in higher ed, working for Upward Bound at Western Michigan University, transitioned to actually working for K-Connect here in Grand Rapids, learned about the community school model and the community school strategy, and it just kind of gravitated towards the organization. But yeah, this year, well, this past school year, we supported about 20,000 students in 46 different schools. And yeah, it's great work. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the strategy and how we do work in partnership with schools to accomplish our goals.
All right. Thank you, Dr. King. Next up, we have the Juliana Estrada. And let me just, can I give some back story about Juliana? Because we met back in my role with our community's children when I was doing the two college through college work. And Juliana and I, we met at the downtown market. We were like, okay, you're doing this, I'm doing this. How do we collaborate? You know, mm-hmm. What do we do? And as the program officer at the Grand Rapids Community Foundation, I've seen from the start till now how you've supported the Challenge Scholars Initiative. So, yes, tell us more about yourself, Juliana, and what brings you into the conversation today?
Yeah, of course. So thanks for having me here. So, I am a program officer at the Grand Rapids Community Foundation, and I have been leading the Challenge Scholars Initiative for the last 8 years. So we have been friends, partners since about 8 years ago. And really through that work, we have really focused and centered our students, which is really what brought me to College Through College and working with the T2C Studio in partnership with Challenge Scholars. And really, it's just been a journey to follow students since they were in sixth grade through college degree attainment. And we have learned quite a lot through that. And I've been in the nonprofit field for about 12 years now, over 12 years actually. And really have dedicated to, collective impact initiatives, through the K-Connect and to College Through College and other networks like ALSAME. And so really, what I'm bringing to the conversation today is really uplifting the voice of our students and their experiences and really just sharing with you all what we have learned and maybe some recommendations in terms of how students are experiencing this educational ecosystem and what we could be doing to improve those outcomes for them.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I do want to shout out Juliana because she is a proud member of the College Enrollment Align and Design team. So looking at, like she said, at the systems level about what's happening in the ecosystem and how we can better close those gaps. You heard me mention a little bit about the Education Summit. And obviously the goal is to bring collaboration, innovation, and an advocacy. But there is a focus that's really wrapped around student well-being. And I think that Juliana and Dr. Keenan know that very well. And so a focus is around student well-being, student wraparound services, making sure that we are supporting our students holistically and looking at those policies that could affect that. And giving community and students and families a voice to be able to talk about what impacts them the most. And so before we go on our questions, I really just want to make sure that the listeners know, yes, there's education policy, but these are the topics that we're going to be talking about at the Education Summit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, let's just get right into that, Megan. I think that we are in a time right now, right, where there are many, many threats to student well-being. And so it is critical for that conversation to be at the forefront, right, of April 19th and beyond that, quite frankly. But just you all here as experts, I'm going to lean into you, Dr. Keenan, first. What do you see as some of those threats right now impacting our public education system? We talk so much about the impact on our systems, but let's talk about the impact on the students.
Yeah, so it is. There's a lot we could talk about, and I'm going to start with probably, what I feel is most important to me personally and professionally, and that's the students. Obviously, we want to create learning spaces where there is a sense of belonging and where kids want to be there. Unfortunately, through certain policies and different types of initiatives and programs or whatever we want to call them, that's not always the case. By design, the system of education, specifically public education, I guess is where I'll drop anchor. It isn't conducive of inclusivity. Well, let me backtrack. It isn't always structured to be the most inclusive environment, and it isn't always equipped to best meet the needs of all students, right? So I do think that with funding streams and things like that kind of being on a chopping block, those systems don't move in a direction that further benefits students. They actually swing the other way and can kind of create spaces that, you know, for 50, 60 years or whatever, we've tried to calibrate them in a way that make it so that they are more conducive of, you know, the success of all students. It could be something as simple as hearing devices for students with, you know, hearing impairments. It could be wheelchair access. It could also be celebrating different cultures. I mean, it can look a lot of different ways. And I just think that through some rhetoric and through some misinformation, certain political ideologies have advanced the notion that by making these spaces more inclusive, they're actually taking away from other students. Mm-hmm. And that is just completely, I feel like, not the case. Whereas especially when you ask a lot of young people, they'll say, well, we want to learn about each other. We would like to engage deeper with different communities so that we are better human beings. But yeah, I think that it might be parents. It might be, again, political ideologies. But, you know, protecting our kids and creating spaces, preventing potential threats that seen or unseen, foreign, domestic, whatever it is, I think it's our job as adults to say, like, yeah, our children want better from us, and this is how we're going to be better. To just not have a conversation or to limit their access to information, I feel like it's not positive.
Yeah, and, you know, I really hear as you're talking community, right? Like the need for, like when we talk about the potential threats that can have a harm on our, like can harm our students, there's a role for a community, but there's always been a role for community, right? Like you even think back to some of those like foundational scholars, right? Like the John Deweys and whatnot, like around community and school. So can you talk a little bit about the community school model and how that helps maybe intervene or you know, intercept some of those potential threats?
It would be my pleasure to talk more about the community school model. So, as I stated, I'm executive director for KSSM, which is the community school initiative here in Kent County. Been around since about 2006, implementing the community school strategy. We do this largely through the role of what is called a community school coordinator. So we partner with districts to embed a full-time FTE community school coordinator 40 hours a week in that building every day, regardless of the size. We do have two at East Kentwood High School. It's a huge high school. But they're there every day creating spaces that, to my earlier kind of sentiment, that students want to be in. We do this through a structured approach. There's a framework. It's called the Six Essentials for Community School Transformation. Collaborative leadership is one of those pillars, expanding enriched learning time and opportunities, rigorous community-connected classroom instruction, powerful student and family engagement, integrated systems of support, and then a culture of belonging, safety, and care. I want to talk a little bit more about the integrated services, though, systems of support. So when we talk about what kids need access to that maybe the school district isn't fully equipped to address. For example, mental health services. Historically, educational spaces were not really designed to meet all the dynamic needs of students from a mental health, trauma-informed, you know, whatever you want to call it, wraparound. They come there, they receive education, they go home, right? Like old school thinking. But we saw student achievement increase when their mental state, when their behaviors are being addressed. And where better to do that than right there at the school where the young people go every day. So with the community school strategy, that's the approach. We try to make sure that the young people have access to the things they need to be academically successful through a place-based approach where the place is the school that they go every day. So it's less about, it is about education, but it's more about the vehicle to which we can deliver our services. And that vehicle, like I said, is called a community school. And again, integrated student supports, if you're familiar with the MTSS model, multi-tiered system of support, there's three different tiers. Tier one is everyone in the school. That's where KSSN wants to be. Tier two is more like behavioral health, maybe a little bit drilling down into group therapy. So, you know, you might have a couple students. I'll use this as an example because it's top of mind. So like teenage pregnancy, you might have a group of students going through that. They just need to talk with their peers about what that looks like. And then you have tier three, where that's your IEPs, your 504s, your more district-supported special education programs. Now, again, most of the capacity in the MTSS model is at that tier three level. Where are there structures at in a school district to address, for example, cultural celebrations and belonging and things like that? So here lies an opportunity for a lead agency like KSSN to say, okay, through a partnership with a school district, we can work on some of the things that we know through the MTSS model will help keep kids in school and be academically successful, but that you are probably equipped from a bureaucratic standpoint to deviate resources into. Another layer to this is we know public education is not the most robust funded, you know, bureaucracy in the country. Yeah. So we also use a funding model to leverage, you know, certain streams of funding going into the district and other streams of funding in the community to then blend and braid a funding structure that basically says one school district dollar is leveraged to almost be like $7, right? So the financial implications are there, the student implications are there, and I definitely could talk about each one of those six essentials in depth, but I do think that when you ask me what the potential threat is to our students, is if that MTSS model doesn't have the capacity it needs to address student challenges, barriers, or whatever, kids go unseen, and then they drop out, and then teachers look ineffective, and then principals look ineffective, and then superintendents look ineffective, and the state of Michigan looks ineffective. Mm. Now the opportunity index data comes in, and our literacy scores are almost the worst in the country. So you can look at like the domino effect that is just not having coordinated efforts, coordinated systems leads to students kind of being pushed to the wayside. Back to the community school coordinator, it is their job. They're there every day building these systems. It's their job to connect with community. It's their job to understand where the partnerships lay. And that looks different across all of our school districts because the needs of schools are all different.
Yeah.
But I would say our primary thing, increasing attendance, getting them there so that the educators can do the job that they need to do. And it's the long game. We want to make sure that we are supporting good, healthy students so that they can become good, healthy members of society.
Yeah. And what you're defining is, right, that student well-being. And you talk about that ripple effect all the way from, I mean, it can start at kindergarten and how it impacts a student even transition into post-secondary education. And I know that, Juliana, you do a lot of work with the Challenge Scholars. You have heard from students kind of what their needs are. In our college enrollment group, we even identify those wraparound supports as financial support, mental health, career services, basic needs. So there's a combination of supports that impact our students that's needed beyond just, okay, you go to class and then you go back to your dorm or you go home. So maybe you can you talk, Juliana, can you talk a little bit about kind of those potential threats, you know, how this impacts students that are in post-secondary education and what you've heard?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I agree a lot. Like, a lot of what you're saying, Dr. Keenan King, is like, we can see the results of that with our college students, right? Whether it's on the positive end where they have received these types of supports and coordinated systems, or it's on the other end, right, where it's just been very inconsistent and have not been able to receive that coordinated support. And so I guess in terms of threats that I see are, you know, obviously right now with the political environment, those like identity-based, you know, scholarships, the immigration, right, and things that are real for our current high school students is the first set of students that comes to mind. Because, you know, in going to the schools recently, we get to see what is real for them, right? Right now, immigration, mental health, well-being, who they are as an individual is a big thing. And in terms of their access to information is a big deal because we're wanting to get them ready for college, for post-secondary journey. And to this point, it's still difficult for students to understand what FAFSA is. It's still difficult for students to understand what it means to find like the best fit, you know, college for them. And that is troublesome because between now and the fall, when it's real, when they get to see what that tuition bill looks like, when they get to see what it's like to live on campus, they're going to start asking all the questions. And by then, although it's really important that they are asking the questions, it's a little too late, right? Because they are already in the trenches with all of that. So I would say, you know, some of the things that we have been identifying and working with students is really having that coordination. Like how are we walking alongside with students through this preparedness or this readiness into post-secondary? And, you know, when you think about a student, and I was kind of reflecting a little bit on this as you were talking, when you think about a student, you oftentimes think about the books and supplies, right? What your class schedule is like. Make sure that you're in this building from, you know, 7 to 3 or whatever the time is. But when you think about students as human beings first, that changes the perspective and that changes what they need, right? You no longer just need to go to class and be on time. You need all these extra supports in terms of, are you ready for class today, right? What other things might be happening, right, that are hindering that readiness and that forward thinking, where there's so much happening that you're just thinking about the now. So we tend to see that a lot with like the college students as well. So like it's transitioning a little bit into the college arena once they, it's a huge transition. And I'll share, I do want, like I said, I want to elevate the voice of our students because we do hear from them, and a huge shout out to our students because we've been able to establish like a strong relationship with them where they are able to open up to us about experiences that they have. And we work with them, right, to really help them identify like what would be the next pathway for them. So some of the things that we hear from them in terms of challenges or things that would be, you know, at risk for them is that time management. So really becoming that adult, right? Time management, that transition from high school to college, you're no longer in the one building all day. You're navigating a community. Some students have expressed that they are depressed and overwhelmed. And to that end, how do you point them to the right person where they can build trust, right? And it's no longer that counselor down the hall. It's a building and it's a therapist potentially, and some of those words sound scary to students. So from my perspective, I think those are big pieces in really thinking about students as human beings first, and then what they need to be successful as students second.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, your students that you work with. Can you provide like a brief history about the Challenge Scholars, you know, and just in regards to some of the successes that you may have seen, data, impact since the launch? Because I know you said your students, but listeners would love to hear more.
Yeah. So, you know, I can't just speak about Challenge Scholars without, like, mentioning all of the other supports that the Grand Rapids Community Foundation has done. And just very briefly, you know, they have supported education in so many different ways, but they're always, like, filling in some gap, right? Like, way back in the 1940s, they were filling in, like, scholarships for nurses because there was a nursing shortage, right? And, you know, you can see how that support and how we're filling in that education gap has changed, because now we're looking at creating conditions that support that college and career readiness, right? And so through that comes Challenge Scholars. Challenge Scholars is an early promise scholarship program that was launched in 2012, which was way before my time at the foundation. But it benefits the students that graduate from Union High School between the classes of 2020 through 2028. And what is really unique about Challenge Scholars is we talk about it as being more than a scholarship, because, yes, we are scholarship providers, you know, by trade, but we are also grant makers. And so Challenge Scholars also has a grant making component through the Dream Fund. And back in 2018, we were recognizing that doing a large grant to specific organizations or specific partners, the funding wasn't trickling down as far as we wanted it. And we were hearing loud and clear from students and staff that they needed some of those resources. So with support and leaning heavily on our community partners, students, families, they all came together to really design what the Dream Fund was or became. And so to this day, we're keeping that commitment of the scholarship, following those students from the last cohort of 2028 through 2032, and supporting them in those ways. Then came 2019, and Dr. Shayla Young, you'll remember, we again were recognizing that our ecosystem or the education landscape was shifting quite a bit during that time, with the Promise Zone coming into play. And we knew already that the first cohort that would benefit from the scholarship was the class of 2020, and that they were going to need our undivided attention, per se, in that transition from high school to post-secondary. And that was just a whole new space for us to navigate. But then we all know what happened in 2020. And so it just shook everyone to the core. So there was a clear need to really accelerate that tension or that need, that we needed to pivot. And so, you know, we put together the advisory committee that was, filled with, you know, partners like Dr. Shayla Young. We had a board member on there. We had representation from the higher eds, even from GRPS, to really help shape what that pivot looked like. And so to that end, it really just came to, okay, how do we shift from this place-based or this small pocket of Challenge Scholars that is really impactful? Through the years, and shout out to Chris Cutsley, our program director, because she's always infused a level of evaluation and, you know, developmental, like, learning through the programming. And so now with that advisory committee and with approval from the board, we decided that it was time to sunset Challenge Scholars as it is, but really pivot towards implementing a lot of the learning from Challenge Scholars into our educational strategies. And so when there's a sunset, there's also a sunrise, right? And that's where we're at right now. We're approaching that sunrise with a lot of the work that we're doing. And so a lot of the learnings that we have from Challenge Scholars will show up in our general scholarship programming that we offer through the foundation.
Wow. Thank you both. And I think what I'm just hearing, right, just reflecting on both of y'all's contributions to the conversation around what the threats are, and then just like your role as an organization, it really almost feels like that paradigm shifting that you are living out. Juliana, I heard you when you said, when you start looking at students as humans. Like, we have basic needs as humans that have to be met. And then, Keenan, you reference things like mental health supports, right? Even seeing cultural representation of yourself in the schools, like how important those things are. How do we start to, and again, you guys are doing this, but what more do we need to do to really shift this from a conversation or just a few organizations that are thinking and doing this way to like this being a full-blown approach that we see lifted in Kent County and the state of Michigan and beyond? And, you know, Keenan, just given your national, right, partnerships and whatnot, you might have some examples of that already happening too. So, yeah, what does it take to get there?
With the change in political climate, it's kind of hard to nail down and say this is exactly what we need to be doing right now. But I think just like any movement needs coordination and strategy. Mm. And I think some things have been done to kind of intentionally keep us on our heels. And with that being said, I think giving us an opportunity to say, okay, if we are feeling like we are on our heels, so to speak, how do we, to your point, pivot that to having more proactive or responding on our toes? You know what I mean? Like, so I think it's really not a secret. We've been struggling. The fight for equality, the fight for human dignity has been one that has run in alignment with American history since this experiment that is America began. But I do think that it's all about building coalition, building allyship, trust, and regardless of where our organizations and what you look like, we all have a common goal, and whatever that common goal is, making sure we all understand what those, I guess, strategic priorities will be and how we can best push the agenda forward. It seems like the need for our services, for wraparound services, or creating environments where people want to be seems to be greater than, I don't know if it ever was, you know, I haven't been around forever, but you know what I mean? Like it is definitely hitting a point where our community is hurting. And we know that our babies are hurting. Like, I have, you know, quick story, second grade student doesn't show up for school a couple weeks ago. Administrators are freaking out. They're like, did this kid get picked up by ICE? Yada, yada, yada. Worst case scenarios. All this hysteria, turns out kid's fine, just not feeling well. But in an effort, like, without having a strategy, without having coordination, you see some of this fear start to bubble up. And it's real fear. Real fear. I talked to our lawyers. They're like, yeah, there's been one student picked up by ICE in the state of Michigan. This was like 2 weeks ago. I don't know if that's changed. But that student was picked up during a routine traffic stop. And that was a Syrian student, which is African, right? It was just like a routine traffic stop. The student didn't have papers on him or whatever. So this fear of ICE being in our schools and snatching our kids off the street is a real thing, regardless of if it's fact or fiction. Yeah. It's a real fear. In the absence there of a strategy or in the absence of coordination to say, this is how we respond to these things if they do happen, or this is how we prevent them from happening, you just kind of have a bunch of people running around acting crazy. And like I said, when I think about the struggle for human dignity and how far we have come and how far we still have to go, the only way it really works, I mean, you look at civil rights, you look at Cesar Chavez, you look at Stonewall, you look at any organized movement, and they were coordinated. They weren't scattered. That can actually lead to the movement being undermined by not having the consistency you need to be successful. So that's where I'm at. We need to get together. We need to mobilize.
Yeah. You know? And I even, you know, building the muscle, you know, knowing how to do, how to how to move, right? Like even I just think about community members, those parents who are steeped in their lived experience and haven't fully grasped that it's an expertise and that there's power, right, in community organizing. And in this day and age, you almost wonder like where the real power is at, because who's saying what? And, you know, even just debunking some of these myths around how to engage or why to engage or can I engage in this movement or in a movement, right? And so it definitely, to me, it's equipping community too to be engaged in that, because that parent of that student is going to have more impact than I ever could, right, than we ever could representing that story. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Juliana, what are your thoughts on the matter?
I guess where my mind goes is who has the privilege to be upspoken, right, or outspoken about mobilizing. And when we think about, you know, the student that you talked about or parents and, you know, other families, they're living in real fear. And you're not going to share what your plan is in case someone gets, you know, detained. And so we're starting to see that with different organizations as well, right? Where their funding is being threatened. And you can't really be outspoken about what you're doing because of that fear of getting your funding pulled or having other organizations that are following, you know, our federal government's orders about, you know, reporting, right? Different organizations or groups that are doing the thing. So I think that is also real among the different organizations. However, through K-Connect and through other collective impact groups, I wonder how we can move past the gathering and the conversation. We know what the data is saying. And the data has been telling us the same story for years. And so now it's time to, how do we activate? How do we put some strategies into action? And how do we coordinate those actions, right? Who are the right people to be at these spaces? Because yes, it is important to have leadership at these conversations, to perhaps approve or okay some direction that Collective Impact is taking, but who is doing the work and how is that? How are those conversations getting brought back to the organization? I think is really important. And one thing that I happen to see quite a bit is the lack of sharing. So we gather together to talk about these things and we see all this national data. But when have we come together to really share our own data, right? Our own work that we are experiencing or seeing. And I think we just need, someone needs to take that leap of faith and like really demonstrate what that looks like to really mobilize others, right? Or inspire others to, okay, they are collecting the same information that I am. Oh, they are seeing the same thing. And right now we're missing that culture of sharing. And so right now we're working with a really good learning partner through Emergence Collective, which I've kind of shared a few comments on those in other meetings. And one of their practices is returning learning to the system. And to that has, like, I've been holding on to that ever since we started engaging with them, because it's true, right? How are you returning what you are learning, what the data that you are collecting, these stories that you hear, right? Those interactions with students and families. How are you bringing that back to the internal organization? but also to these collective impact conversations, right? And what are some proposed solutions? And so how do we get past identifying those problems the same day, the same story that data is telling us, towards action? And I think, you know, the Education Summit and the different, you know, webinars and things that we have coming up through K-Connect, I think would be the start of that, right? And I think the Education Summit could really play a role in activating some of that action.
Yeah, just to add, because you brought up a great point about how K-Connect as a collective impact organization working here locally to address some of these power dynamics by creating these tables and these spaces where, regardless of where you come from or emerge from, your voice is valued. Now, again, those marching orders look different depending on, again, the organization you represent or how you've come to the K-Connect space. But collective impact, for me, is a strategy to help to address the threats. Kind of like Juliana was talking about, we just have to make sure that we're on the same page. But to say, you know, you come out, share your data, and then people use that data against you as a weapon. This is why school districts, so being vulnerable, sharing power or giving up power. And this is where some of the culturally responsive pedagogies, theories, things like that come in, where you start to think about how power has been unequally distributed intentionally to keep people from feeling like they have the agency they need to make progress. So, it's really near and dear to my heart because I think through education, I have been liberated personally, right? And if you withhold that same type of education from students, they cannot be liberated. So then they just become these, like, you know, sheeple. And to a certain extent, individuals benefit from more sheeple and less free thinkers. So if we can't even have a conversation about how the system has undermined, either by design or unintentionally, some of our previous efforts or current efforts, if we can't create spaces where people can lean in and be vulnerable, then those conversations don't happen, and the same dynamics will continue to perpetuate themselves. But like I said, I think we've made a lot of progress in this country over the last 150 years. I don't know if you even want to go that far. But it is. It's like we still got a long way to go. I heard a rapper say this. Shouts out to Nasir Jones. We are a country in its infancy. And comparably speaking to a lot of the other countries, industrialized, modern, whatever you want to call them, countries in the world, civilized, if you will, whatever that means. So we still got a lot to learn. And the militant critical theorist in me wants to say that, yeah, we need, by any means necessary, right? Like, by any means necessary. We don't have time to wait. But I think through my leadership journey and even just leading KSSN, change is sometimes slow, and evolutions happen when they need to happen. And we adapt to our environment. We survive. Life is about survival. So as much as, like, we get down on it, may seem doomy and gloomy right now, I do think forcing us to have conversations, podcasts, the spaces that I'm talking about, because we can see this looming thing kind of approaching us, forces us to adapt and survive. Thanks. So.
And you all said, I think now is the time for collaboration. So, like, now, right? It's the podcast. It's the Education Summit. You know, switching it so that now community members, families, students can actually quote data and understand what's happening right in front of them. And we get that it is, you know, it is a time of fear. And it's in homes. But hoping that this summit and the work, and it's not just the summit, right? The summit is honestly, we talk about it at K-Connect, phase one, right? Getting the information out there, getting seeing and gaining the feedback, educating. Okay, then what's next after that? And that's when we're able to put into action. So Summit is really just the beginning. But we're talking about, you know, obviously there's a lot happening, you know, nationally, but the work still has to continue with what you all do. So just with everything happening, do you all maybe have a story or information of how you had to adapt maybe your services to better support students? I understand that, you know, you all are working with Emergence Collective, but is there anything that you're like, yes, this is all happening, but we have been able to adapt and move forward in this way because we know we are student-centered and the work must continue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So one of the bigger pieces that we think about is how can we make our financial resources flexible? So again, you know, with the Promise Zone coming into play, right, and kind of like really shaking things up for us in terms of financially supporting students. And then came the Michigan Achievement Scholarship, and then came like a whole bunch of other, you know, tuition free programs with other institutions. And all of that just really made us think, okay, wow, like, at least from my perspective, right, being the scholarship provider for Challenge Scholars at the foundation, was like, well, this is bigger. The world of scholarships and financial aid, it's its own separate thing, right? And how do you navigate that? So, you know, there are scholarships. There's this whole thing where you talk about scholarship displacement, right? And if your scholarship is worded a specific way, or you have certain criteria that is limiting how those funds can be used, then the student misses out on that funding, right? And so then they end up with a balance. And as a student, you would never know, right, that that is happening. Usually it happens on the back end, and you never are even aware of that. And so I think that that's just a missed opportunity there for the student. But one thing that we have been doing is being flexible with that funding. So our scholarship doesn't go just to tuition and fees or books and supplies. It's towards their cost of attendance. So typically we also have learned through the years to work closely with the student and the financial aid office to ensure that all other aid is applied as effectively as possible, and then we can come in towards the tail end and cover that balance, right, for the student. And so it takes a lot of coordinating with the student to helping them understand how to navigate even like the online system and what their bill is saying, even the timing of things. Each institution is really different in terms of their timing, what their bill looks like. I know what I'm looking for on those student bills, but man, they are hard to understand. They all look different. And for some institutions, a certain financial aid does apply, and for others it doesn't. And then you come, you know, across the financial aid suspension, all of those things, right? And so how are you navigating all of those spaces? So that's been one way that we have been pivoting and really paying close attention to. I think now, you know, with the most recent changes with, we don't know what's going to happen with federal aid, right, or financial aid in the coming months. And so really thinking through, okay, what are we hearing? What might be the next direction, or in what ways could we be supporting students? Another thing that we're doing is helping students, or awarding a fifth year of funding. So Challenge Scholars Scholarship is 4 years. But we know well that, you know, life happens. And particularly as a first generation student, it can take you a little bit longer, right? So we do award a fifth year to our Challenge Scholar students, and even support those study abroad experiences as well. So getting, you know, different, you know, opportunities in terms of education is really important. I mentioned financial aid suspension a little bit ago, but one thing that why that matters to us is because a lot of times you can appeal a financial aid suspension, but you most of the time you have to enroll full time to get that appeal approved. And the condition is that you need to pass all of your classes in order to receive your financial aid back onto your account. Well, whatever the student is going through, is probably that's not setting them up for success. They need time to be able to address the things that are getting in the way and also have some time to dedicate toward their classes. So with a full-time schedule and then trying to address the challenges that they're experiencing, that's not setting them up for success. So in some cases, we have been able to come in first, award the student as their primary scholarship so that they can enroll part-time and be set them up for success. So it gives them the time and we are able to connect them with the resources or at least guide them in a direction that will address the barrier, the challenge that they're experiencing, and also set them up for success academically, right? To be able to pass those classes. And so I will say that that's been, you know, those tough conversations and where it really matters to establish that relationship with the students to open up to you about what is happening, right? And yes, you're following the direction that the school is telling you by enrolling full time, but is that even realistic? And so those are the types of conversations that we have with the students and that we have been able to pivot to support them in their success.
You said a lot of great things, but can I get some snaps, claps, and likes for fifth-year scholarships? Yes. I was like, okay, that is real. What we need. I was clapping over here. Like, I can't clap in the mic, but, you know. Yeah, so, though, that is great to hear. And, you know, we can actually shift that same question to you just kind of with the work that you all are doing in schools, and maybe there's been a shift of how you've been able to adapt and support your students.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I want to one-up that fifth year because it definitely takes us a
little longer.
Some of us a little longer than four, and that's okay. It's about finishing. But yeah, I would say for KSSN, and I'm going to say some things knowing that this will be published later. Who knows what will happen tomorrow. We ain't pivoting. We can't, honestly. If you're familiar, for the listeners, if you're not familiar with KSSN, our inception, our birth, our DNA is advocating for the marginalized and the ones who maybe slip through the cracks or whatever. That's in the DNA of KSSN. Now, the community school model is fluid and dynamic enough to meet the needs of any student in any system, right? So I don't care who you are or where you come from, family engagement is important to student success. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, when we do the work, and because of politics and systems and things like that, we had to prioritize where the highest needs were. So again, because we are an organization that addresses student circumstances through a model that was birthed based on social innovation, what we're doing is not working. We need something different. This is that something different. You want to know what else is different? The other, diversity. Some of these other things that I do think that, yeah, we can pivot on the language. That's easy. Let's just call it belonging. Let's call it whatever these people want it to be called. But the work is the same. And so, yeah, the Community Foundation, I do think, you know, pivoting, making sure that, you know, y'all can get y'all finances off and making sure that people could best use them. Absolutely. But to say that the needs of our families and the needs of our community have drastically changed, therefore, should we pivot, like, to be able to do the work? We still need after-school programs.
Yes.
We still need mental health services. Mm-hmm. Without getting too soapboxy, we still have a lot of needs. And I just do feel like as KSSN looks to be dynamic in meeting the needs of districts and students, it's hard to say, like, this is where we'll pivot what we have going on. But like I said, I'm saying all of that knowing that, again, this will be published later. Yeah. And the political climate has been changing what seems to be on a weekly basis. So, you know, there's letters coming out that says if you don't cease partnering with, if you don't stop centralized DEIB operations, or if you don't stop partnering with adjacent organizations that are doing DEIB work, then you risk losing federal funding. Again, what does that mean?
Yeah.
What does that mean? So we in this wait and see. And I've told our team and our whole organization and our board that until we know, we doing the work.
Absolutely.
And I'll be damned if under my kind of leadership that changes, because that has not been the response, I feel like, of our organization ever. It's to just, you know, it's not like, oh, this is scary, we should stop doing this. No, we actually need to lean in further and say, okay, why is this so challenging and how can we figure out? Because again, these young people just keep going, their needs go unaddressed if we stop. So, respectfully, I do think that we can't, and I do think that there are ways for us to still do the work. Yeah, we might say things and move a little different, a little bit more strategic, a little bit more coordinated, but just to hit it home, the work is the work, and it ain't getting no better. It's actually, it feels like it's getting worse. It feels like anxiety is getting worse. Mental health is getting worse. Like, yes. Access to therapists, social workers making six figures now because they doing their thing, and social work shortage, teacher shortage.
Yeah.
You know, student mobility issues. I mean, we can go all day, like, yes, with these challenges. And again, bringing it back to K-Connect, where is there a space visualized on a dashboard where community can get all the information they need in one spot from a data standpoint, and then take that data from an action orientation standpoint and say, this is my role with this. Parents advocate for their babies way harder than we ever could.
Yeah.
We just have to equip them with the skills and knowledge, bringing it back to the community foundation. I know that's some of the work that y'all are doing to be able to do parent-led advocacy efforts.
Yeah.
Looking at how KSSN has access to these parents. We work with a lot of parent advisory councils, things like that, and the districts. So this is that mobilization. This is that coordinated shared vision. This is that, and again, just bringing it back to K-Connect. Y'all the ones doing it here in King County.
And like you said, until we know, we're doing the work.
We're doing the work.
And even then, the work is still the work.
It's going to be there.
Look, and I need all of us to coordinate and be there on April 19th.
Okay. But no, this is really great. And I just want to even just shed some light on why we're having this conversation together. Because we're talking about the K-12 system. We're also talking about the post-secondary system, right? And so, like, what does it even look like to have that integrated P2P, preschool to post-secondary model that really emphasizes that a student who might need mental health supports or different layers of support at the K-12 level might also need them at the post-secondary level. And this is a continuum. This is a continuum type of conversation. It's a continuum type of lens and action, right? I think about our work plan, the K-Connect work plan, and how, you know, along that continuum of our 27 indicators, these are looking at some of the major life transitions from being born healthy all the way into career success, right? And so I think that I just want to emphasize that, like, even on April 19th, we're going to be having the conversation in one room together, because this isn't where systems get siloed. We have to look at the whole picture. We have to, if we're looking at the whole student, the whole human, then we're looking P2P. All right. Well, you know, I think we're wrapping up here. Any lasting thoughts or final thing you want folks to know? They're coming on April 19th. They're engaging in the virtual sessions. What do you want folks to know about, you know, the work you're doing, Education Summit, or just any lasting remark to leave our listeners with?
So again, I want to share a little bit of what we've heard from our students and really talking about, like, building that sense of belonging, that community. I think back to the days where I was working closely in the middle schools with their community, their CSLT meetings, community school leadership team. And that was amazing to witness, because you were bringing community into the school, right? And you could see all these adults and different organizations represented that are coming because they care about the student well-being, right? And that was at a really young age. And so I really held on to that from back then to really, what does that look like at the high school level, right? So we have the college and career coordinators at the high school level as well to work with those students and start connecting them to the post-secondary people, right? And so we wanted to infuse some of that into the students' college experience. So we do have some Challenge Scholars point people on some of the campuses to be that point person or that familiar face, that community person for our students. And so I'll just share a quote from one of the students from last year. She said, "My success coach is great. We meet once a month to discuss life updates and more. It's good to have someone just an email away who is with you every step and genuinely cares and shows her concern about your success and most importantly, your well-being, regardless if that is her job." And so that to me is like really elevates the importance of that sense of belonging, that well-being, and just it touches on so many other aspects of the student well-being. One of the data points that we recently learned from our conversation with our with Emergence Collective was that we're seeing how our students that are in third and fourth year, because they've had time to already establish relationships on campus, either through peers or different student clubs and whatnot, even when they're having a tough semester, like if their GPA is lower, they rate their semester higher because they have that social component. They have that sense of belonging. Where in comparison, students who are in their first or second year, they may be excelling academically, but because they don't have that social component, they rated their semester lower. And so that to me has just been really resonating, and it's just been amazing to see that in some of our data with our students.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
So thank you for the shout out. The community school leadership team, again, like Juliana mentioned, is a group of community partners that come into the school based on the school's need to address the challenges that may be existing or the opportunities. So it's not always bad. Like, it could literally just be like helping people, like the Literacy Center, for example. You have new Americans coming here, and they need to learn English. The parents of students need to learn English to get jobs. Like, it's a workforce development play, really, in the long game, but this is how we keep parents engaged. I've seen multi-generational approaches where we have Kim Rwandan elders in there reading books to the kids through a collaboration with senior neighbors, AmeriCorps. So it looks different depending on the assets of community. And again, the community school leadership team is a community school coordinator led meeting on a monthly basis to address the, like I said, challenges or opportunities that exist in that building. So yeah, thank you for that. Just want to make sure I mention that. And I guess in closing, you know, I've already kind of hinted at some of the structural issues and some of the systemic challenges that we face. But I think that, you know, to leave you with, like, you know, make time for, like, joy. Yes. Making time to be okay with the world. And I'm telling y'all this because I need to do this for real. You know, it's okay to turn the TV off and spend time with your family and get back to work. You know, I'm embracing this whole rest is power stuff. It was kind of foo-foo-y, and, you know, it's not in alignment with the hustler's mentality that I feel like I have adopted throughout my life. And I think, you know, the balance, and even for our coordinators, I see y'all, I know it's tough, that balance. Mm-hmm. So just make sure your life has balance, and let's keep fighting, because, you know, if it ain't us, then who will do it? I don't feel like this is the task of anyone other than the people that are entrenched in the work. Like, we shouldn't be expecting others to do this work for us. So that's all. And if you do want to learn more about KSSN, tap in with me. find me, KSSN, or I think it's kentssn.org. Even if you're just a community partner looking to learn more, or a funder looking to engage deeper with the work through investment, collaboration and relationships are, again, part of our DNA. So.
Yeah. I love that, Kenan, that you brought up a good point. It's like, you know, we care about our students and we want student well-being, but we got to care for ourselves first to be able to pour in students' life. And that's something to remember. Dr. Shayla Young and I actually got to meet with a group of high school students yesterday where they talked about student well-being, and they talked about factors like the school culture plays big with them as far as like clubs getting involved, flags being represented around the school, you know, being able to be proud of your culture and share different languages. They talked about technology influences, family influences. So we all, I mean, it's a shared community effort to support students and their well-being. And so you just brought up some great points with that. So I know we're getting ready to close. And I know Dr. Shelly Young always has something fabulous to say on the ones and twos.
You know, thank you. Thank you, Megan. My partner in collective impact here, Megan Frierson. So we, when you both were talking there, all three of you actually, the quote, "Joy is a form of resistance," by Austin Channing Brown. Come on, somebody help me out. Yeah, so joy is a form of resistance, and remembering the joy and even that experience we had yesterday with those students was a form of joy for me in this work. So shout out to all of the coordinators, KSSN coordinators, all of the challenge scholars, point people who are making it known that checking on students and knowing about how they're doing is somebody's job. So shout out to all of y'all. And if you want to hear more, maybe you heard this discussion and you're like, yes, and come on April 19th. Need to register?
Yes,
k-connect.org/EdSummit. Come see us. Let's keep going in this work. Thank y'all so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for joining us for the Pace Forward podcast. This episode has been brought to you by Connect Us, transforming communities one system at a time.